Beloved, in order to understand the significance of Adonijah's becoming king in our text this morning, we need to understand very clearly that Solomon was the divinely appointed successor to King David. God had told David before even Solomon's birth that he would become king and as such build the holy temple. 1 Chronicles 22, verses 9 and 10. God said to David, "Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies round about, for his name shall be Solomon, peaceful rest. And I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. He shall build an house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever." And then, after Bathsheba gave birth to one of her four sons, we read that David called his name Solomon, and the Lord loved him, and God sent by the hand of Nathan the prophet, and he called his name Jedidiah, which means beloved of the Lord, because of the Lord. And God's love for Solomon, also called Jedidiah, refers to his saving love for him in Jesus Christ, in election and the cross and right through his life and even beyond his life into glory. And this reference to God's love for Solomon also conveys the truth that the Almighty loved Solomon as the theocratic king, God's great representative over Israel, in a special father-son relationship, a special covenantal mercy. I quoted a passage in 1 Chronicles 22 that speaks of this. We sang Psalm 89, and before we sang, I drew attention to this. It's there in 1 Chronicles 28 and 2 Samuel 7. It was known that Solomon would be king before and then even immediately after his birth. Those who knew that Solomon was divinely designated as David's successor included David himself, obviously, and Nathan, because I've quoted passages that said Nathan was God's messenger to tell David, and David may well have even been told this truth directly by God himself. Solomon also knew that he was designated David's royal successor. David told him in 1 Chronicles 22. And that same chapter tells us that David proclaimed Solomon as his successor to all the princes of Israel. Bathsheba, David's wife, one of, and Solomon's mother, she also was told this by David, who swore to her that their son Solomon would reign. And that's mentioned several times in 1 Kings 1. And Adonijah himself, the one who usurped the throne in our text, Adonijah knew fine well too that Solomon was to rule over Israel. This is why 1 Kings 1 verse 10 indicates that Solomon was not invited to the coronation party. And, looking further into the passage, 1 Kings 2 verse 15 has Adonijah say, quote, "The kingdom was Solomon's from the Lord." In short, everybody knew that Solomon was going to succeed his father as king. Solomon, David his father, Bathsheba his mother, his brothers, the princes of Israel, the prophet Nathan, and if they knew, doubtless everybody else knew. But our text indicates that there were some who did not want to know that Solomon was to succeed David on the throne. Some who wanted to forget. To use biblical terminology, there were some who suppressed the truth, and more especially now, this truth, in unrighteousness. There were some who were willfully ignorant that God had promised to make Solomon's king. And so they did what totally depraved sinners have been doing with God's truth ever since, and before, and right to the end. They sought to block it out of their minds. They sought to deny it. And they even sought to overturn it. And when I say they sought to overturn this word of God regarding Solomon, I mean especially his half-brother, Adonijah, and the others who progressively joined with him. Let's consider this morning, Adonijah becomes king, noting that he was emboldened by David's weakness, that he was following Absalom's example in usurping the throne, and he was presaging dark times. Adonijah becomes king, emboldened by David's weakness, following Absalom's example, and presaging dark times. Adonijah's bid for the throne was emboldened by David's terminal decline. David, as we saw last week, was old and cold. He is about 70, prematurely weak because of all of his exertions, now needing a human hot water bottle to keep him warm. And you can imagine easily Adonijah's calculations. Absalom, some years ago, he failed to take my father's crown because dad was still relatively young and healthy. But now that he's old and cold, I'll be able to usurp Solomon, his son. Adonijah was also emboldened by David's failure to establish Solomon as his successor. He could have and should have made it clearer and firmer earlier. It's true that everybody, including the people, knew that David intended Solomon as his heir, and that David has said and has done some things to this effect. You read of that especially near the end of 1 Chronicles. But David has actually done nothing final, nothing decisive, to put his son on the throne after him. And now that David is in his present declining condition, it's going to become harder and harder for him to act decisively regarding and in the favor of Solomon. Our text also brings up the idea of what is now called passive parenting. Passive parenting is a polite way of saying, Daddy lets the children get away with murder. When my father was strong and I was weak, Adonijah is thinking to himself, even when he was strong, young, fit, healthy, muscular, and I was a young stripling and weak, you know, he never disciplined me. This sounds strange, but this is what this passage and other scriptures teach. He never even admonished me. Not a finger, and not even a word. Verse 6 states, Adonijah's father had not displeased him at any time in saying, Why hast thou done so? Not once in all the years of his childhood and since did he ever even admonish his son. That's hard to square with David's piety. There's a massive lacunae or gap or flaw here in David. Adonijah is thinking that now that I am strong and he is weak, the tables have turned. Well, he's hardly likely to admonish me if I make a bid for the crown. After all, why would he change the habit of a lifetime now when he's at his weakest and I'm at my strongest? Besides all of this, David and the nation knew that he has lost his moral authority. He committed adultery with Bathsheba, which brought shame upon God and his people, even from the surrounding pagans. He had Uriah, her husband, killed, and he lost his illegitimate son by Bathsheba. And everyone in Israel knew that David, once on a pedestal, has lost it. He doesn't carry the same influence or clout or position in people's hearts that he once did. He's lost it. And after that horrible fall of David, things go downhill in his life, and according to God's judgment and prophecy. Adonijah's half-brother Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar, and Dad did nothing about that. My half-brother Absalom, this is what Adonijah's thinking, and everybody else is too, he took most of the kingdom with him. Sheba, he rebelled too because he knows that David is no longer impregnable. And then there was that other occasion where Dad, who had the Midas touch, and everything he touches seems to go wrong, he foolishly numbered the kingdom and 70,000 Israelites died for it. 2 Samuel 24. Nobody listens to him, even if he were to rouse himself up from what will surely be his deathbed. He's lost it. Nobody takes him seriously anymore. And there is a word for Adonijah's thinking and action. It's called opportunism. It is taking advantage of another one's weakness for one's own personal and sinful gain. This is what wolves and hyenas do. They see a deer or a wildebeest, some other form of animal. It's either very young or very old or sick or injured, and they track it remorselessly. They can sense its weakness. They seek to isolate it from the herd and take it down. And here Adonijah is an opportunist. He's not going to slay David. He's going to die soon anyway. There's no need. But he's going to move in and appoint himself David's successor because David is too weak to stop it. Now, besides David's weaknesses, which bring him down, Adonijah has two natural advantages which elevate himself, just like Absalom did before him, because he's following his example. Absalom is the model for rebellion against David. The first natural advantage of Adonijah is primogeniture. Big word meaning firstborn. The firstborn son, he will succeed ordinarily. And if he dies, then it's the second born. And if he dies, the third, and so forth. Well, Amnon, David's first son, is dead. He was murdered by Absalom. Absalom, David's third son, he's dead. He was slain horribly by Joab. There was a second son in between those two called Kileab or Daniel. And either he was of little or no consequence, an unassertive person, or as most think, he's dead too. Not by unnatural causes, but just natural causes. That's what the view I take to. It's the majority position for what that's worth. Adonijah, he is David's fourth son. Verse 6 ends with this line, his mother bare him after Absalom, the third son, who was at that stage the eldest living son, and who's now dead. And the text says his mother bare him after Absalom. That is, by the normal rites of primogeniture, Adonijah should be next in line to the throne. And this advantage of primogeniture focused Adonijah's mind. You know, I can make a bid for the throne here. And this would influence the people too. People would say, you know, he does have a right. And in especially medieval history, you know of instances of this where the king favored one of his younger sons and said that he was going to succeed him. But an older, the eldest living son, he then makes a bid for power because he knows that that idea that the oldest son inherits the throne has a hold on people's minds. Adonijah is going to exploit that. But you, and this is a hold in your mind, you know that primogeniture isn't always the way God operates in the Bible. Esau was Isaac's firstborn. And yet God said, Esau, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. It didn't go according to the natural advantage there. David himself was the eighth and last of Jesse's eight sons. But God chose the youngest of eight to be king. And here Solomon, apparently, he is at least number 10 out of David's 17 sons. You can look at the passages in 2 Samuel 3 and 2 Samuel 5 and work this out. He's at least 10, number 10 out of 17, and he's the one God picked. But Adonijah is thinking to himself, number one, I'm the eldest of the surviving sons. And number two, I am, Adonijah now speaking, extremely handsome. Verse 6 says that he was very goodly. And very goodly in our authorized version doesn't mean ethically he was very good. It means in terms of his physical attractiveness. He was goodly, handsome, very goodly. And this alerts us to the fact that the kings of Israel had certain natural advantages and characteristics. Saul was extremely tall. He was a head taller than anybody else in Israel, and his shoulders were at the level with the second tallest man in the land. And people saw him and said, that's obviously the new king. And Saul, just to stay with him a bit longer, Saul was also good looking, because Saul was not only the tallest man in the kingdom, but he was the most handsome man in Israel. 1 Samuel 9 says that about him too. Saul was very attractive. He was succeeded by David, who was very attractive. Absalom took the throne in Jerusalem, and he wasn't only attractive, he had the best head of hair of any man in Israel, and probably of any woman in Israel. And now we have Adonijah, and he's one of a long succession now, Saul, David, Absalom, and now Adonijah, who was very, very good looking and looked regal. There's a pattern, and he is in accordance with that. Why should he not be king? This is what he's thinking. I'm David's oldest surviving son, and I am, because he could look in the mirror just as everybody else could see him, though the mirrors weren't as good back then, very good looking, just like all the others who have ruled over Israel. And our text speaks of various stages in Adonijah's ascent, politically and religiously, or one could say descent, spiritually and religiously. The first, it began with Adonijah's self-exaltation. Verse 5, then, in the light of David's sorry demise, verses 1 through 4, then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself. Adonijah is not content for God to exalt him, if that's God's will, or for others in Israel, the church, to exalt him, if that's God's will. He exalts himself. His problem was self-esteem. He was proud. And pride here issued in his own self-elevation in the church, Israel, and wherever that happens, in the Old Testament or the New Testament, someone elevates himself in the church. That results in strife and division. It always does that. It grieves the spirit and it brings about fighting. Adonijah's self-exaltation. Then comes his evil resolution. Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. I will reign. It's not enough for me to be a prince. I've got to be king. Just like Absalom, who was the eldest and who was the most attractive and who exalted himself and who resolved to be king, not merely a prince. This was also the thinking of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. The Levites wanted to be priests. They already had high office. They wanted higher. The princes wanted to be rulers like David. They had high office. They wanted more. But Adonijah's sinful will and firm resolution was not the sovereign will of God ultimately. And it was not, and he knew it, it was not the revealed will of God. Self-exaltation, firm resolution, and then we read of his royal transport. He exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And in keeping with that resolution, he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Here's the idea with that description. Adonijah, he is in the central grandest chariot. And there are other chariots before and behind him. Think of a presidential entourage. The main car and other cars around it, black sedans. Then there were outriders on horseback surrounding the royal entourage. So there's prestige there and also a degree of security. And there are 50 runners going on before to prepare the way. Clear the path, clear the path. Adonijah's coming. Stand aside and gape. The man is appearing. Okay, okay. And then it goes past and people are impressed. And then the people think to themselves, who's really running this nation? David? Private? Remote? Inactive? I think that's his bedroom up there on the third story of his palace. Somebody said the other day they saw a curtain twitch. And then there's Adonijah. Public pomp. He's amidst the people. The people can see him. But he's also above the people, somewhat aloof. A majestic figure, and he conveys power and prestige. And David, shut up in his room, and Solomon, we never really see much of him. And what he's doing with this royal transport, what he's doing is just what Absalom did. 2 Samuel 15 verse 1, it came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Even the same number of men. He's emulating the last rebel among David's sons. How then does this go over, this regal transport through the streets of Jerusalem? How did David respond? Verse 6. His father had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? David didn't say boo to him, just as he had never rebuked him. And Adonijah had calculated correctly. There's a war of strategy here. How's my opponent going to react? And he's understanding his adversary. And then, of course, David's failure to admonish his son emboldens Adonijah further. He's able to get away with it. He can push it further next time, just like our children do try to do with us. How then did the people in Jerusalem react? Well, they noticed that Adonijah was a very attractive man. And this impressive conveyance through the streets of the capital heightened his natural beauty. Verse 6 says, he was also a very goodly man in terms of his physical appearance. And it's inserted here in verse 6 to indicate that this is not only a fact, but this is what the people are increasingly realizing. He's handsome. And then they remembered too that since Absalom's dead, and Amnon and Daniel or Kileab apparently too, they remembered that Adonijah was actually David's oldest surviving son. The old ideas of primogeniture, the eldest son surviving, outliving his father, gets the crown. And that's why in verse 6, and at this point, his mother bare him after Absalom. Adonijah's stock is rising. It's rising very, very high. The people see it, and Adonijah realizes that they see it. And David, he's doing nothing. And with the swell of support growing, Adonijah goes further. He's pushing the envelope. He approaches two key men in the kingdom whom he reckons can be won over, and two men whom he needs for a successful usurpation. He needs Joab, and he's the head of the military. If you get Joab on your side, you're going places. And then there's Abiathar, the high priest. If I can get the two of them on my side. Verse 7, he conferred, and this I tell you is after the order of the royal entourage. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest. This raises the question, why did Adonijah reckon he could gain Joab's support? Well, Joab knew that he had lost David's favor through his murder, and it wasn't too strong a word to say murder, his murder of Abner and Amasa, and one could even add Absalom. David didn't like that act either. Joab knew too that David had already tried to replace him as general unsuccessfully with Amasa. And Adonijah knew that Joab thought that way, and he knew that Joab was the sort of man who showed loyalty. He was like a number two. He didn't want to be number one, but he was a man who would show loyalty to the number one over him, insofar as the number one guy over him had the power and will to offer him the most. Joab, David, if I come in and get, then I can offer him generalship of the new army under me. Yeah, Joab will go for that. And he was right. He had the measure of Joab too, just as he had the measure of his father, that his father wouldn't do anything if he went in a royal chariot through the streets. Why did Adonijah think that he could win over Abiathar, the high priest? That one takes a little bit more of thinking, and our answer is not just as certain, though I believe it is the correct one. At this time, there were two high priests, Zadok and Abiathar. And I put them in that order because that's the way invariably they appear in the Bible. Zadok and Abiathar. Zadok and Abiathar. Not Abiathar and Zadok, but Zadok and Abiathar. 1 Chronicles 16, verse 39, 2 Samuel 15, verses 24 through 29 indicate that there was a first among those two equals. And Adonijah evidently recognized that Abiathar resented being the second among equals, and that Abiathar, the high priest, desired to be the sole high priest, not only first among equals, but the only one. So he approached Abiathar, and the two of them, the high priest and the general, were won over. They followed Adonijah, and then, and this is how things work, they, following Adonijah, helped him. So that Joab brings most of the army in support of Adonijah, and Abiathar brings much of the priesthood and many Levites. The groundswell of support is swelling. And let's compare this with Absalom's rebellion, because 1 Kings 1, the inspired spirit means us to understand it in the light of 2 Samuel 15. When Absalom rebelled, he knew that there was one man that he needed on his side, Ahithophel. Because Ahithophel was a genius, a wonderful strategist. And he could give you good plans for how to go further. And then if you had him on your side, then everybody would rally behind you, helped by him. And yet, Absalom, even though he had Ahithophel on his side, he failed. And he failed in part because Joab and Abiathar were loyal to David. And now he, Adonijah, has Joab and Abiathar on his side. It makes sense. Adonijah, though, is a realist. He knows that he wouldn't be able to win over certain other people. And so he doesn't try. They're mentioned in verse 8. Zadok the priest. No, he's not gonna come along with me. Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. He's very loyal to David. Nathan the prophet. Well, he's the one who prophesied that Solomon would be king after David. He's not going to agree. Shimei and Rei, we don't know so much about them. The mighty men which belonged to David is 30 men, with the first three and the second three. They've been with him through thick and thin. No, no point even bothering with them. I have enough. I have enough with these two guys and their influence and the swell of the people. So if he makes his next move, he has enough support to do that. His final bid for power, a coronation ceremony. And he uses the draw of good food and religious appeal to win over the uncertain. Verse 9, Adonijah slew sheep and oxen by the stone of Zoheleth, which is by Ein Rogel. He slew sheep, oxen, and fat cattle. And the word slew is the word for kill in a sacrificial context. So this is religion. Religion has a powerful hold over people. This is a sacrifice. And then some of these sacrifices evidently are peace offerings so that the people can eat. So good food and a religious ceremony to appease people's consciences and reach them through their bellies. And this, of course, then wins over two more key parties. He invites all his brethren, the king's sons, apart from Solomon. He has all the princes on his side now too. And all the men of Judah, the king's servants, they've been working around the palace and they can see that David's past it. They think the future is with Adonijah. So now the royal princes and the palace servants, and even more widely than that, they follow Adonijah too. The location for this coronation ceremony is interesting. Absalom, you will remember, made his bid for power and raised his standard in Hebron, a city to the south of Jerusalem. He lied to David that he was going to fulfill a vow made to God, and so David should release him. He went to Hebron, raised the standard. Absalom's purpose was to consolidate his power there and then move north and take Jerusalem and wipe out David. Adonijah, he doesn't need to go to Hebron. He is crowned, this was his idea, outside the walls of Jerusalem because he wants to move immediately thereafter to the palace. Because David's no longer the force that he was, physically or morally. He's old and cold. Crown me here and then I can move in and take over. We don't even need a battle. The precise location is worth noting too. We're told that it was by Ein Rogel. And Ein is the Hebrew for spring. The spring of water there for washing and preparing food. Zoheleth, the name of the stone, means serpent. Serpent stone. Serpent stone. And on that stone you can slay and prepare the food. And there the seed of the serpent is attacking the seed of the woman. And Adonijah was successful in his usurpation. In the next few dozen or so verses after our text, we read four times that he reigned. In verse 25, the people shouted, "God save King Adonijah!" The acclaim of royalty. In chapter 2, verse 15, Adonijah said, "I got the kingdom." He's king, he's reigning, he's over the kingdom, and the people shout in triumph his name. The next thing for him to do would have been to enter the palace, sit on the throne, and start passing edicts as king officially enshrined in that building. And then chapter 1, verses 12 and 21 indicate then the next thing to do is take out Solomon. He'll never have peace while Solomon's around. And take out his mother too, because she will always be fighting for her son. Regarding David, we can let him be because he's old and past it, and he's going to die anyway. And if we have him up in that room for a wee while, it might even lend a luster of credibility. We have the support of the old, cold man in his chamber. The text presages dark times. And if we step back from the text and ask ourselves more generally, what would this mean for God's Old Testament people were this coup to be successful, for them not only to reach the throne, Adonijah and his people, but stay there and effect their plans? Well, obviously, no Solomon as king. No temple. And Israel would have as its ruler an ungodly and murderous brute who would rule according to his own nature and promote apostasy and idolatry in the land. And for that moment in history, that's what people thought was coming. And if we zoom out further, the New Testament reality here would be no Christ. Because Jesus Christ was typified in his royal office by Solomon. No New Testament church, because the temple which Solomon built was a picture of the church. And the promise of God, As God promised that Solomon, the type of Christ, would come, God promised that the temple, the picture of the New Testament church, would come, the promise of God then has failed. And so our text is one of those instances that deals with the absolute sovereignty of God in connection with the coronation and kingship of certain chosen special servants. Because as soon as God says that someone is going to be king, then, and the next few pages of the Bible seem to be filled with it, then all hell moves to oppose that plan. We no sooner read regarding David that David is the man after God's own heart, and he is going to feed God's people Israel, that we've got page after page of Saul hurling javelins at him, hunting him like a partridge around, trying to get him in his bedroom and kill him. And you think, I didn't expect this. I thought God was going to make him king. It'd be nice and smooth. The next thing you know, we'd read of a coronation. But he's a fugitive. And then Saul dies. And you think, oh good, David's going to become king. Ah, but there was a son of Saul's that you didn't know about. The Bible hadn't mentioned him, called Ish-bosheth. And then he gets 10 of the tribes. And David has another 7 years to go. And eventually he becomes king. And then he becomes king, he commits adultery, and his own son tries to kill him, and he's chased out of his capital city. And then he puts down the rebellion of Absalom, and the rebellion's no sooner down. And then Sheba rises up. And you think, poor David's never going to get any peace. The man, God anointed him king, and it's been nothing but bloodshed and internecine struggles. And you almost think to yourself, the last thing you need is a promise of God that'll mean he's going to build the church through you or in connection with you, because all it seems to be is just trouble and strife. And then we've got Solomon. And Solomon means peaceful. You think, oh good, here we're going to have a nice, smooth transition. And Solomon's rule was peaceful. But before he gets to rule, that's where the trouble comes in. And you know that the story does not end with 1 Kings 1, verses 5 through 10. There's the rest of chapter 1, because the tables are going to be turned very emphatically. And then comes chapter 2, the kingdom's going to be established. And then with the kingdom established, we learn about Solomon's life and work as a type of Christ, building the temple, a picture of the church, with the promises being fulfilled and realized. And so it's no surprise when you come to the pages of the New Testament with both David and Solomon as the two great types of Christ as king over Israel, that though God has said that Jesus is the Savior, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, it's not just one triumphant victory parade where Jesus comes, everybody bows down and worships him and says, this is the one we've been looking for. Herod tries to kill him. The Jews seek to push him off the edge of a cliff. And then, when it looks as if he's popular and things are swinging his way, they nail him to the cross and put a plaque over it saying, this is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Have a good laugh at him, because he's weak and despicable, and he's being tortured and about to be killed as a loathsome criminal. But even that had been prophesied, not only by example with David and Solomon, but in the second psalm. We're going to sing it very shortly. The heathen raged. The nations, including the nation of Israel, plotted against the Lord and against his anointed. And God used their execution and wickedness to exalt his son, because yet he appointed Jesus as King of Zion in Jerusalem. And after the cross, where Jesus made atonement for all the sins of all of the true citizens of the kingdom of heaven, the Israel of God, the real Israel of God, the tables turn on the first day of the week with the resurrection. He then ascends into heaven with a far greater throne than David or Solomon ever had. He sits at God's right hand, And he says, one day, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that I really am Lord and King. When I return and I cast my enemies into hell and recreate a new heavens and a new earth. Amen. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we thank thee for the intricate passages of the Old Testament that expose the evil machinations of men and that give us hope too that Christ will build his church so that the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Give us, Lord, a deeper love for the narratives of thy word. Help us to see the truth, for these truths to shape and inform our lives and thinking, so that we may believe and cling to the promises, even when the kingdom and church seems to be going to pot. For Jesus' sake, amen.